Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thanks, everyone. How are you? We are delighted to have you here. I have some official duties to do before we begin. I always feel like a judge when I do this. Good evening and welcome, everyone, to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club. We are delighted to have you with us. Tonight's program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Dan Ashley, ABC7 News anchor, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors, and delighted to be your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Spencer Christian, who also happens to be one of my dear friends at work, one of my dearest friends at ABC7, and our longtime weather anchor. Even more important for tonight's program, he is author of the new book, You Bet Your Life, How I Survived Jim Crow Racism, Hurricane Chasing, and Gambling. It's a terrific read and very revealing, and I think very inspiring as well. Spencer, of course, is an Emmy Award-winning reporter, best known for his 13 years on Good Morning America, which is where we first met, actually, when he came through Charleston, South Carolina in the early 90s, where I was anchoring the news with his Good Morning America team, Charlie Gibson and Joan London. He covered the national weather reports on Good Morning America, in addition to traveling throughout the United States and all around the world, reporting on a wide range of topics. Since 1999, he has been the weather anchor at ABC7 in San Francisco. And tonight, you're really in for a treat, because you're going to hear his amazing personal story, which will amuse you, will probably shock you, and it will certainly inspire you. It inspires me, having known Spencer all of these years. Growing up poor and black in the rigidly segregated South, Spencer relied on his family's strong values to overcome adversity. On Good Morning America, from 1986 until 1999, he was a daily presence in the homes of millions of Americans, no doubt many of you. By every conventional standard, he had it all, a loving wife, two wonderful children, a beautiful home, and a rewarding and remarkable and unusual career. Yet he was living a double life that was largely unknown to the TV viewing public. For nearly 30 years, he was a compulsive gambler and fully addicted to the high roller lifestyle. By the time he found the courage to confront his dependence on gambling, he had lost more than $3 million. His home, his job, and most importantly, his family. So tonight we're going to discuss a lot of things about Spencer, but we'll discuss what happened in those years, his rebound, rebuilding, and now his triumphant recovery. Please give a very warm welcome to my dear friend, Spencer Christian.
Thank you. Thank you.
Spencer, as I said, we've known each other for a long time, and we'll get to the topic, the meat of your book, and the point to your book, I think, that the inspirational part of your book in a few minutes. But let's just go back in time a little bit, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
And walk through some of the milestones in your life, and both professionally and personally. You grew up in my neck of the woods. I'm a North Carolinian. You're a Virginian.
Right. Adjacent states.
Exactly right. And you grew up poor in the segregated South.
Right.
But with a family that really valued education, values, and integrity. I think that made a difference. Tell me a little bit about what life was like for you in those years, early years growing up.
I will do that. May I first say that the wine I'm holding in this glass is for medicinal purposes?
Yes.
Because, seriously, I was losing my voice earlier because of some allergies. So someone kindly poured me a little glass of red wine to help the vocal cords. It's not easy, Dan, to describe what a routine day in my life was like when I was growing up to people who did not share that experience or who are unfamiliar with it. But every day when I left my home to go to school or to go out with my parents to go shopping or to go anywhere in the world outside home, there were literally signs that told black people where they could and could not go. If you went into a store that had restrooms, Some stores had only one restroom. It would say whites only. If there were two restrooms, there would be one that said whites, and it was always well-maintained and clean, and there would be one that said colored, and that one was always allowed to be dirty, rusty, not very inviting. Water fountains, same thing. Playgrounds usually weren't just segregated. There was no blacks were not allowed in the playgrounds. Arthur Ashe, the Hall of Fame tennis player, was from Richmond, Virginia, could not play tennis in the public tennis courts in Richmond. So his family, when he was an adolescent, sent him to the North, where there wasn't that kind of rigid racial barrier, so he could be trained to pursue a tennis career. Schools were segregated, movie theaters, every place of public accommodation either said you could not come in, or if you did go in, you had to go through the back door or go to a place that was designated just for you. Now, facing these kinds of daily indignities, and it got harsher in some cases. I mean, people were sometimes attacked and harmed physically just because of the color of their skin. But facing these daily indignities is something, or was something, that certainly left psychological scars in many people, and you can imagine why.
Sure.
But every day when I returned home to a loving, supportive family that encouraged me to have a positive, aspirational approach to life. I don't know how they did it under those circumstances. My parents were remarkable people. But home was a safe place, always. Mm-hmm. I never felt threatened there or unsafe there, and I always felt loved.
Well, it is such a powerful story. As I said, we grew up in similar parts of the country, although Spencer is maybe a dozen years older than I am, 15 years. So the world had changed a little bit by the time I was coming of age. So I didn't see all that personally. But when I hear the stories, and Spencer and I have had this conversation many, many times over the years, it hurts me to think of my friend. It's hard to imagine America that would treat someone as wonderful as this gentleman that way, and I think we can all relate to that. But one of the things that always has impressed me, Spencer, is that you mentioned psychological scars, and I'm sure there are some in all of us, no matter what.
Right.
But I'm sure there are things that have lingered in you. But you have always risen above that. You bear no ill will. You bear no deep scars that I'm aware of, and you always have maintained that sense of optimism and a good-naturedness about it, despite it'd be easy and understandable for somebody to be bitter and angry.
Yeah.
And you never have been bitter and angry.
Sure. Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't have a simple answer to that, but I can give you an answer to that. I think a lot of it has to do, obviously, with the example my parents set. My dad was part of that generation of young African-American men who went off to fight in World War II in a segregated military. And when they returned home, they were still not extended basic everyday freedoms. They still lived in a segregated world where they were discriminated against every day. They were not welcomed home as war heroes. And somehow, through all that, they maintained a belief in the American dream. They were patriotic under circumstances that would turn almost anyone unpatriotic.
Right.
When I say there, I mean my parents' generation. Their investment of hope and hard work and prayers and tears, their investment was in their children's generation. They pointed to, something my parents did every day. We'd sit and watch the national news after dinner. They would point to every advancement that was made during the civil rights movement cite that as an example of why we should have hope. Things are getting better. Things will improve.
They literally pointed that out to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So after, even if the news report was unpleasant, showed the police in Alabama or Georgia beating up the nonviolent protesters, my parents would say, but you see now there's civil rights legislation and Congress is going to pass it and the president's going to sign it. New opportunities will arise. So, I know it sounds kind of corny, because there certainly was reason to be outraged. I mean, I felt a sense of moral outrage. I recognized the injustice of the way things were. No doubt about that. But somehow I understood from the example my parents set that I would probably be able to open more doors in life with a positive attitude than with a resentful one. And that's basically what it boils down to.
And that has guided your demeanor, professionally, personally, your entire life.
It has indeed.
And let's move now to education being an important part. For those of you who don't know, you can tell just as you listen to Spencer, he has a great curious mind. He's a highly intelligent guy. He's my grammarian at the station. It's true. If I can't figure out what to say, what word to use, or if I'm spelling it correctly, I ask Spencer, and which I always appreciate.
He's... I wish our writers and producers would do the same thing. Yes,
me too. But education lifted you out of your circumstance, i.e. being poor.
Right.
And it was something your parents clearly instilled in you and recognized as the way out. Am I right?
They did. Both of my parents grew up in large, poor families during the Depression. My dad was one of 11 kids. My mom was one of 10. Mm. They both had to drop out of school around the 9th or 10th grade to go to work, which was a common thing in large, poor families during the Depression. So they had limited formal education, but they were, very intelligent people, had, dreams for a better life for their kids. They taught me to read when I was 4. And boy, they unleashed a fury after that because I was curious about everything in the world. Books became my windows onto the world. We couldn't afford to travel and see exotic places, but I could read about them and I could dream of one day going to them. Mm-hmm. And now I have.
Yeah. You went there in your mind through reading.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly right. Yeah. I wish more young people today understood the value of what that does to spark your imagination.
Absolutely.
And also to educate you to read. So how did you get into television? You started, as I did, in a small market television station. How did you find TV as a career?
it still kind of puzzles me how I found TV or how TV found me. I was in college in the late 1960s during that student activist generation, and there was a lot going on in our society, as you may have read, in the late 1960s, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, anti-war protest, and it was a time of widespread political and social activism among young people, especially college students. And I was in college at that time and found it all very fascinating, and I worked in political campaigns, and I was so fascinated by the way the news media covered these profound changes that were happening in our society, that I decided as an English major and a journalism minor, right, I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a news reporter and help enlighten the masses. See what a job I've done? But my interest was in print journalism. I had no interest in broadcasting, never thought about being on TV. But as I went knocking on doors at newspapers to try to get a job, a friend of mine who had worked in a campaign with me told me about an opening for a news reporter at the NBC TV station in Richmond, Virginia, which was about 20 miles from where I grew up. So I thought, I have no experience in TV. He said, well, no one has experience until they get their first job. So I wrote the news director a letter and sent him some samples of my writing. And he was like the Lou Grant character from the old Mary Tyler Moore series. He called me up, said, come on in, I'll talk to you, kid. And I went in and met with him. We hit it off right away, just like that. He gave me a little studio audition. I had never been in front of a TV camera before in my life, but I didn't feel intimidated. And so you know me well enough to know to not be surprised, I guess. And so I did. I guess it was a smooth, confident reading. And he said, kid, you're a natural. You're hired. And that's how I started in TV. Like something out of a movie.
And so there you were in that television station, that small town near where you grew up, learning a relatively new medium at
that's
that
true.
Time. And there were not many people like you on television at that time
that's
for you
true.
To look to.
I was the third person of color hired on local news in Richmond, Virginia, ever. That was in 1971. The first guy worked at my station, too. He started in 1967. So it's not like the newscasts locally had become very diverse by the time I started.
Was that difficult? Did you stand out in a way that was made your job hard or being accepted hard, both in the public and in the professional with the colleagues that you worked with?
You know, that first guy, Ed McLaughlin, had paved the way in such an amazing way that it really wasn't that uncomfortable or difficult for me. I didn't go into work every day feeling self-conscious or wondering how people were looking at me because of the color of my skin. However, there were some odd things that happened from time to time. For example, the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is based in Richmond, Virginia. Many landmark desegregation cases went through that court. And as a young news reporter, before I started doing weather, I covered that court. And occasionally, I'd walk out of there to do my stand-up to talk about how a desegregation case order had just come down to, you know, open up the schools. And I'd see protesters out there who were opposed to desegregation. They wanted to keep things segregated. And they were marching and carrying their signs with, you know, ugly words on it. But occasionally, one of them would look at me and go, "Oh, hi, Spencer. I'll watch you tonight." Like, what is that about? I'm one of the people you're protesting against.
That's in the abstract, but yeah. They know you. It's interesting.
Weird thing, yeah. But I felt comfortable from day one. I really did, yeah.
And then things progressed for you, and you began to get different opportunities. And we'll fast forward a little bit. And one day you wind up on national television in all of our homes, Good Morning America.
Yeah. A couple of years into my stint as a news reporter at that first station, the longtime weatherman there quit unexpectedly, and I was asked to fill in for a couple of weeks. Well, during the time that I filled in, the general manager said that our ratings had gone up, and I became a hit, so he asked
me. And prior to that, you were a news reporter.
Yeah, strictly a news reporter, Right. And I still think of myself primarily as a journalist, right. Even though weather has taken me to where I am. So once I started doing weather, I was in a more visible role, more prominent role in the newscast, started getting offers from bigger markets, and in a short time ended up in New York at ABC, at the local affiliate in New York, which is WABC, ended up there in the mid to late 1970s. And then I started filling in on Good Morning America, and by the time by the mid-1980s, I had joined GMA full-time. And fortunately, we had some very visionary management there at ABC News at that time, and they encouraged me to exercise my journalistic skills and to do a wide range of reporting on whatever topics interested me, in addition to doing the weather.
Sure, yeah. Which you did, and if those of you watched Spencer over the years in Good Morning America, he found himself in the thick of it in all kinds of situations, not just weather situations.
Yeah.
He did lots of high-profile interviews. Went out and did a number of sports stories around the country and the world. Professionally, I mean, I know you love what you're doing now, and this is a place you wanted to live when the GMA opportunity changed. But was that that must have been a professional joy those years? I know you worked all kinds of crazy hours. It was difficult, and you were on the road constantly. Right. But it was great fun, I would
imagine. It was. Challenging, demanding, and incredibly rewarding, personally as well, and professionally as well as financially. The experiences I had during the GMA days clearly were the highlights of my career in terms of the assignments I was on, the people I got to meet and interview, the places I got to travel to. I met and interviewed so many people from all the most prominent people in the world in all kinds of fields, politics, entertainment, sports, 6 presidents. Mm-hmm. But some of the most remarkable and memorable people I've met were not the famous people, but they were the ordinary people who had done something extraordinary in their lives.
There's no question, having done this for 30-plus years myself, people ask all the time. I've met many famous people and done many different interviews with them. But some of the most salient are the ordinary folks that I can think of when I covered the Columbine High School shootings, the people I met there, Hurricane Hugo. The people that you cover, ordinary folks in extraordinary circumstances, tend to stick with you more,
over the years. You know, I mentioned hurricane chasing in the title of the book. I was on 14 hurricane assignments, in addition to covering floods and blizzards and all sorts of natural.
Do you ever think management maybe didn't like you?
They were trying to send me a message.
Maybe and, it just blows away.
Sometimes I did. In some of those hurricanes, I literally had to wrap one arm around a utility pole while I held the microphone in the other hand with my goggles. Yeah, and my feet were being lifted off the ground sometimes. But in those circumstances, you know, you saw so much human suffering, mm-hmm. and so many people who had lost every material possession they had. And in many cases, you saw people performing heroic deeds, you know, to help save a neighbor they hadn't spoken to in 10 years. And then they would all hug together and cry together and pray together. And those are the most lasting memories I have of all the assignments, more so than, you know, meeting and hanging out with the rich and famous.
Yeah. Well, you certainly had the remarkable professional experiences. But now let's turn to sort of the topics of your book. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned hurricane chasing. That is sort of self-evident. You covered, as you said, 14 major hurricanes around the country. I've done that as well. They're all the same and they're all different at the same time. And they're all scary.
Yes.
When you do that, I have to say.
Yeah, all of those.
But let's talk. You talked a little bit about how you survived Jim Crow racism, mm-hmm. how you carried some of that with you, but released it in a way to allow yourself to fulfill your destiny, for lack of a better way, and reach your full potential. But during all of this, these great opportunities that came your way because of the Good Morning America experience, you were hiding something.
Yes.
And I know it's difficult. It was difficult to talk about and certainly to write about, and not many people knew about it. But you had a problem.
Yes.
You developed a problem. Tell me first how you developed this problem. Where did it come from?
What's the genesis? It started, Dan, in the late 70s, when I was at WABC-TV. On Friday nights after the 11 o'clock news, a bunch of guys would get together and have a friendly poker game. Mm. I put friendly in quotes for those who are listening on radio, air quotes. And the friendly poker game was, it was fun, end of a work week. I'd play for a couple hours on a Friday night and then go home at 2 a.m. to spend the weekend with my family. But the friendly poker game quickly grew into a high-stakes game, a cutthroat game. And initially, you could win or lose maybe $200 on a Friday night. It got to the point where you could win or lose $2,000. Mm. So that was when gambling first started to get its claws into me. But then in the late 70s, casino gambling opened up in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And that was about a two-hour car ride from where I lived. Also, in the summer of 1978, my wife and I made our first trip to Las Vegas to see Barry Manilow. But
he writes the song.
You write that make the whole world sing. I would walk into the casino, and there was all this stuff going on that was electric, the sights and sounds. And the first couple of times I went to a casino, I got lucky and won a few hundred dollars. And that rush was so intoxicating. And that's how it started.
Well, and curious for those, because I've gone with friends to play blackjack or something, certainly played friendly poker, but I don't have that desire. It doesn't do that much for me. I'll do it to kill time. What is it that you liked about it in those early poker games and then when you go to the casinos? What was the attraction?
It's hard to articulate it. There is a certain excitement in that rush when you're winning and raking in all these chips. Not that I needed an extra couple hundred bucks because I was earning a lot of money at the time. But I think as I've tried to analyze it, and I think I've analyzed it more since I finished the book than while I was writing the book, I think it was escapism for me. I think I had always been, the good kid who played by the rules and did what mom and dad said and got home before the curfew hit. And all of a sudden, here I was doing this thing that was exciting and different, but it was legal, but it was not the real world. It was an unreal world being in the casinos. And I think there was something about that feeling that it gave me that was intoxicating. Mm, it was like a narcotic. I could get out here and I can misbehave now, and it's okay. Right. I don't have to be the good boy anymore.
Well, that makes sense. And certainly living in the public eye, there's a certain expectation that people have. Yeah. And you kind of can't color outside the lines too much. Mm-hmm. And this is from someone in the audience, which is on point here. What role did being a national figure help or hurt your gambling problem?
It probably encouraged it because I was traveling a lot for Good Morning America. The regular routine was that just about every Thursday after the broadcast in the studio in New York, I would be sent to a remote location somewhere out in the country to do the Friday morning show. And then the deal was I would fly right back to New York. Well, I had already begun gambling. It was already hooked by the time I got to GMA full time. So on any given Friday, if my assignment was west of the Mississippi River, once I got off the air, I would take a flight to Vegas and spend Friday night in Vegas and fly back home on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Or if I was east of the Mississippi River, I would take a flight to Atlantic City instead of back to New York, spend Friday night gambling. And then I also took my family with me on vacations to Vegas, or my wife and I would go to Atlantic City with other couples. And yeah, but I got to the point where I was doing the high roller thing, you know, where you get the luxury suite and the gourmet meals and everything is comped. So I tried to convince myself that it was expensive recreation and just a comfortable, an exciting lifestyle. But I realized about 3 or 4 years into my gambling compulsion that I had a serious problem. But by that time, I was too embarrassed to admit it to anyone else or to share that.
It must have been a terrible burden. I mean, to live with. I mean, you had a problem and you couldn't really share it with people. It must have been really hard.
It was a huge problem. There were a couple of things in my life that gave me great joy: my family, raising my kids, my job, mm-hmm. my faith.
Yes.
But although it may sound weird that a person of faith who talks with God every day could develop a problem like this and let it consume you for so long, I did. And so these were the things that gave me joy and some balance in my life. But I had many sleepless nights lying there wondering how I'm going to pay all the bills and cover this the gambling debt and not let the world know, not let people discover what a problem I have. So as the years went by, I found myself living on the verge of financial collapse, financial ruin, because I had lost so much money gambling. So I would take out an extra mortgage here or an extra credit line there. And I was a master of playing the borrowing game,
right,
because I had high income and I had a terrific performance as a debtor, paying my credit cards off and things like that. So I was able to easily get these loans, but that's all I was doing. I was living to service these loans and balance the gambling debt and not let the public discover it.
I can only imagine the pressure that put you under. Every single day.
Tremendous pressure. Tremendous pressure. If I had not had those things that gave me the joy I talked about, I would have lost my mind, or I would have stopped gambling sooner. Mm. Maybe I would have sought some help. But as long as I had something to give me some joy and some sense of balance in my life, and as long as I was earning enough money to keep this house of cards, no pun intended, going, I just felt like I was ashamed to acknowledge to anyone else. I mean, it took me a long time to admit to myself that I had a problem, that I was an addict. Mm-hmm. But I certainly didn't want anyone else to know. I didn't want the people at my bank to see markers coming in from the casino. I didn't want my colleagues at Good Morning America to know that it was just more than fun, that it was a compulsion.
And Spencer, is that because I mean, you're proud, but you're also so intelligent. And how did you get into this mess? And you didn't want to disappoint people and all of those things, I would imagine.
Didn't want people to think, I thought he was a smart guy. He's an idiot. You know, I didn't want to be viewed that way. Mm. But what I was doing was certainly idiotic.
Well, but a lot of people get in various situations that they regret. I hope I've not shared this with Spencer, but I hope you don't mind me sharing it here. But Spencer, I've known each other for a long time, and I knew many years ago, before this book came out, that Spencer had this issue. He confided in me on a couple of occasions, and I remember before he confided in me, we were talking about the weekend, and Spencer, I hope you don't mind me.
No, I don't, not at all.
But
it's all in the book anyhow.
Spencer had told me he was going to Vegas for the weekend, and then, oh, good, have a good time. And when I saw him on Monday, I said, how was your trip? And he said, it was great. Unfortunately, I had to do an event in San Francisco. You know, we often MC things and do different charity events. I had to MC an event on Saturday, so I was on such a great run. I flew back here, did the event, and then Sunday morning went back to Vegas to continue my run.
I did. You remember that?
And
story.
I remember thinking, "Uh-oh." I mean, I knew, and I didn't say anything, but I remember thinking, "Uh-oh." I worried about
you. And I was on a winning streak that weekend. So, you know, you'd think that I was going back to try to recoup the losses, which is basically what I did for all those years. Right. But I was on such a winning streak, I didn't want to quit. So I flew back to Vegas after doing my event. Oh, how foolish.
Well, you know, but
it makes good reading, though.
It is. It's very, very good reading. Let me ask you this. What made you, after at long last, mm-hmm. having wanted to, understandably, as most of us would, wanted to hide this from everyone, what made you decide that first you admitted it to yourself, and then you could start to admit it to friends, and then ultimately to the world?
Yeah.
What brought you to that point?
I think it was when I started to get more in touch with my mortality. Next month I'll be 71, so I was probably in my early to mid 60s.
Doesn't that make you angry? Is this not the best 71-year-old man I've ever seen?
still a juvenile inside. And I started to think more about my mortality and how I wanted to be remembered. And as a person of faith, I started thinking more about whether I was living a purposeful and meaningful life, the life that God intended for me to live. But my daughter Jessica played a pivotal role in all this. You know, in the Old South, we have a saying that when you have a sudden awakening and epiphany, you had a come to Jesus moment. Sure. I had a come to Jessica moment. Jessica sat down with me around 2010 or 11. I had given up the high roller stuff, but I was still hooked on poker at that time. And she said, "Dad, as you know, I'm planning to get married. And soon."
Did she know you had a problem at this?
Oh, yeah. My kids knew. Yeah, my kids knew. They worried about me for years. Yeah. They loved me dearly. We had, you know, always had a great relationship, but they were always concerned.
He has two remarkable kids, Jessica and Jason.
They're pretty cool.
They're pretty
cool.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And now I have two grandsons as well. So Jessica said, "Dad, I'm going to bring grandchildren into your life, and I think you need to ask yourself, is this the behavior you want to model for your grandchildren?
Wow.
Is this the way you want to be remembered? And is this the legacy you want to leave?" And she said, you know, she said some very loving and kind things. She said, "You know, you have wonderful qualities, which I love and admire, and I am proud of you, but you've got this problem."
What a remarkable thing for a daughter to say to a
mom. She did. Yeah. And she said, "You know, if you die today, you might not be remembered for those wonderful things. You'll probably be remembered as the guy who overcame all this adversity in this early life and then just pissed it all away," is how she put it.
Right.
And I said,
"Wow.
She's right."
Wow.
Yeah.
That tells you what a remarkable daughter he has.
She's pretty cool.
that sounds like something a parent would say to a child, the wisdom.
You're absolutely
very
right.
Very impressive.
Well, the child is the father of the man, as Wordsworth wrote.
Right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I want to back up one moment because there's something else I wanted to get to. What do you think gambling cost you?
I know
obviously
you don't,
money and all that.
Right,
what did gambling
right.
cost you?
That is a great question. It certainly cost me a lot of time. Although I feel that I was an involved, engaged father, and my kids would tell you that too, it definitely cost me time away from my family. I didn't miss their special events or the soccer games, but I certainly missed just good quality, doing nothing but hanging out time.
Being present.
Being present. It never cost me a day at work, which is weird. I somehow showed up sleep deprived, but I was there every day. It certainly cost me physically because there was all the stress and anxiety that was draining.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't cost me my sanity yet, although that's debatable. but there was a spiritual erosion that was happening there, and I think I became acutely aware of that when I started thinking more seriously about how to deal with this problem and how to end it, how to get it out of my life. I just feel very fortunate, blessed, if you will, that not only was I able to quit and walk away from it, but I feel great today. I don't think I've ever felt better in my life than I feel right now because I'm just so relieved that I was able to tell my story, put it out there. It's like a cleansing confession. And I certainly hope every writer wants to sell a million books. That's not going to happen. But I do hope my story will serve as a source of inspiration and hope for other people facing whatever demons they're facing.
Well, I have to say, you seem as unburdened as I've ever known you.
I am.
You know, in a lot of ways. What has, and you sort of alluded to it, but let's look at the opposite side of the coin. In a strange sense, what did gambling give you? We talked about what it cost you. What did it give you to bring you to where you are this moment?
Well, a little stab at humor. It gave me a good story to tell. I think it's given me the recovery, being able to walk away from it, has given me a greater sense of my own strength, my resilience. It has restored my self-esteem. And
restored your self-esteem.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's another thing it cost me. I lost a good measure of self-esteem during those years I was gambling. There were moments of self-loathing, which is weird because I've always, in a general sense, had high self-esteem. Mm-hmm. But there were so many moments of self-loathing where I thought, how could I be so foolish? You know, how could I let this thing control me like this?
Well, you were worried that you would let other people down, but you probably thought you let yourself down too.
Yeah, yeah, I did.
And that's the self-loathing.
Yeah, but yes, I it has given me this whole experience and being able to recover from this addiction has given me a feeling of strength and resilience of being able to face any kind of challenge or adversity.
This is from the audience, which is an interesting question. Personal struggles can often be a humanizing factor for national figures or celebrities. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that your struggle has better connected you with the everyday individual?
Well, that's a valid question, but I don't think I ever felt or ever was disconnected from the average
individual. I agree with
that,
yeah, knowing
you. I know that sounds self-congratulatory, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do. I agree with that.
I feel very fortunate that, although I've worked for 47 years in this business, which can sometimes be a bit shallow and cosmetic and can give people an inflated sense of self-worth, I think I've avoided falling into that trap. I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. So you've written this book. Now it's very public. Everyone knows the story. You've been on a variety of went back on Good Morning America on
GMA.
National television to talk about this.
They didn't keep me, though.
back to San Francisco.
Right.
Your story is a story of remarkable success, financial, public recognition, professional success, but it's also the struggle of overcoming odds, the poor background, segregated South, Jim Crow laws, and then a personal struggle with gambling.
Right.
What message, what do you hope, because not everybody has a gambling problem, but almost everybody has something.
Exactly. Yeah.
What do you hope that people can take from this book and carry with them?
Well, I'm hoping that people who read the book or hear the story will recognize that no matter what difficulty they may be facing, you are not alone. As you pointed out, no one has perfect peace in their lives. And although I lived a life, a public life, that probably appeared to be the perfect life, you know, and because I truly am a happy person and projected that happiness every day, there were probably many, many people who knew me from TV who thought, oh, this guy doesn't have a worry in the world.
Sure.
And yet I did. So I'm hoping people will learn from my story that, yes, we all have difficulties and challenges that we face. And no matter how far we sink into the hole, no matter how badly we think we've hit rock bottom, you can recover, you can rebuild, you can rebound, and you can rebuild and repair broken relationships, as I have done. Mine weren't totally broken, but they were fractured.
Right.
You can repair fractured relationships. So there were times when my kids were very upset about the direction Dad was moving in, but, you know, all that's forgiven and in the past now. My first marriage ended not just because of the gambling, but that had to be a factor in my first wife's decision after about 30 years that she wanted a new life on her own. But she and I are great friends now, and we're still parenting our two children. And I have remarried, and my second wife is a wonderful woman, and she and my first wife know each other and love each other. And so, you know, I'm just hoping that people who read my story or hear the story will take hope and inspiration from that, that no matter how low you feel you have sunk, you can bounce back.
All is not lost.
Not at all.
From the audience, kind of combining questions, did you get professional help? Did you go through a 12-step program? How did you deal with this mechanically to get over this?
Great question. I do absolutely recommend professional help for anyone with any addiction. So let me say that first off. I did try for about 8 weeks weekly meetings at Gamblers Anonymous. This is going back probably over 10 years. After a few weeks, I didn't feel that I was getting the tools that I needed. So that's not a knock against the program. But the group I was meeting with went through the same little mantra every week. It was like the Stepford Wives, you know, hi, I'm Joe and I'm a gambler. Hi, I'm Jane and I'm a gambler. And I heard the same stories week after week, and it was so depressing for me. It made me want to gamble more. So I don't think that was the point of the
meeting.
No. But having said that, that was just my singular experience. Yeah. I absolutely know that these programs that treat addiction are very effective and useful. So I do highly recommend them. So it was the personal experiences I related earlier. It was, through the unconditional love that people who care most about me demonstrated, that made me feel so cared for that I didn't want to let them down. I didn't want to continue letting them down. And through my faith and through prayer and through all the people who cared about me and offered me their love and support, and through my recognition of my mortality, I decided, I've overcome some pretty big odds in my early life to get to this point in my life. I faced adversity that was imposed on me by the outside world, and now I've created my own adversity. Mm. Now I need to own this, take responsibility for it, and deal with it courageously and honestly. And that's how I rebounded. Yeah.
Do you still, from the audience, do you still struggle with addiction in any way? I mean, when you see poker on television or something, I mean, are you tempted at all? Or when you go to Vegas?
That's a great question. I am not. And I know that's not the typical answer. But I made some friends during my days of playing poker with people who are seen on these televised poker tournaments. Right. So my wife and I were sitting and watching, I was channel surfing just a few weeks ago, and there was a televised poker tournament featuring one of the guys I'm friendly with. And I stopped and said, oh, let me see how Michael's doing, and Lynn, my wife, said, what, you're watching poker? And I went, no, I'm just watching to see how Michael. And then I went on to something else. And there wasn't anything about it that made me feel like, oh, I wish I were there at the table. I also have a friend who turned 90 a couple of years ago, and she had her 90th birthday party at a fancy restaurant in Las Vegas. That's where she wanted to do it. And so I flew out there for the night, went to the birthday dinner at this fancy restaurant. We wined and dined. I went back to the Embassy Suites and got a good night's sleep and came home. And I had to walk through a casino to get to the restaurant. And I was so proud of myself. There was nothing about being there that made me feel like I wanted to go back and play.
Not tempted at all?
No, not at all. I'm so relieved to have this thing off my back. I just
can't imagine going back.
No.
How did that make you feel to walk through the casino and not even really have a twinge? That must have been very empowering.
I felt like I just won the heavyweight championship. Like I knocked out the monster,
Had control.
Yes, I felt like
that's it. Control of something that you had lost control of.
Indeed. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I had control.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from people as you've told the story? Because I know the public saw a gregarious, highly intelligent, highly curious man, very friendly on television, who, as you said, seemed to have the world by the tail, everything you could possibly want. What if people come up to you as you've done book signings and done interviews, come up to you to say?
The reaction, Dan, has been more rewarding than I could have imagined. Many people have said, congratulations for the courage and the strength you've shown to share the story. But many more have said, this was helpful to me because I'm facing a problem, and people have different kinds of addictions or problems or challenges they're facing. And they're saying that, I've taken hope and inspiration from your story. Or they've said that it has equipped them to confront someone they care about who has a problem.
Just as good.
I don't know what part of the book it gave them that equipment, but they, but they felt encouraged and inspired to approach people they cared about and say, look, I want to talk to you because I love you, because I care about you, not because I want to make you feel bad.
As your daughter did.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah.
From the audience, this is a really interesting question. What is the difference between telling others you're an addict versus telling yourself you're an addict?
Oh, that's a great question. It was more difficult to tell myself. During the time that I was caught up in this thing that was so stressful and so anxiety-producing, I consciously wanted to hide it from the rest of the world. I wanted it to be my little dirty, dark secret. But once I began to deal with it and confront it, I realized that the greater difficulty for me was being honest with myself and acknowledging that I had a problem and finding the desire to quit, losing the urge to gamble. Once I got through that part of the exercise, it was much easier then to say to the world, I've got this story to tell.
Right.
Here it is.
Right. Well, we're going to move on from this a little bit, but before we do, I want to ask on the topic of overcoming.
Yeah.
You overcame this gambling addiction. You overcame a segregated South with everything that implies and creates for you. What do you tell young people today, or how would you advise young people today who, especially with what's been going on with the police activity around the country and lots of concern about racism and a divided country, what do you tell young people who believe that they're really facing very difficult circumstances today versus what you experienced? What do you tell them to rise above that or to move past it or to fight and struggle against it?
Yeah. I'm not sure because I tell them different things on different days. I grew up in a generation that saw our society moving in a direction that we thought was a positive direction, a direction of acceptance and inclusion and embracing the concept of equal opportunity for all. Yeah, I mean, we haven't achieved that, but we're moving in that direction through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But in the last couple of decades, public discourse has become harsher. There's more incivility. And there is more open expression of racism and other kinds of bigotry in our society than I ever thought I'd see again after we got through the 60s. And it's been a bit disheartening for me. So I relate my experience and I try to use my example of, embracing a positive approach to dealing with awkward and difficult and maddening situations. I try to tell my story and hope that will inspire young people today to take the same approach. But it doesn't always because, my son, who is 43, says, Dad, I've always been a positive person all my life, but, when I walked through the store, when Jason was younger and he was hanging out with his three best friends regularly, two of his friends were white, one was Asian, and they would go to Tower Records or wherever. And as they were walking out, Jason was always the one who got stopped and frisked, not the other kids. So he would say, how am I supposed to keep a positive attitude when I'm not being treated with the same level of respect and dignity or presumption of innocence as the white guys?
This was in the 90s, probably.
Yeah, and even now.
Did you tell him?
I wasn't sure what to tell him, except that I admired and respected the fact that he had maintained his composure and hadn't created an ugly scene, and that's probably the better way to handle that than to react, in an angry way. But I'm not sure what to tell anyone these days because I can't believe what's happening in our country right now. I thought that was ending 3 or 4 decades ago, but it's back.
And something that you should know about Spencer, he has very varied and wide interests. He's a man of faith. He's been a journalist and a weather forecaster for many years. He's a wine connoisseur, actually, medicinal purposes notwithstanding. he is also a Politico. He loves politics, covered it when he was a reporter, and to this day, if you go, hey, Spencer, what are the two senators from Tennessee? What are their names? He knows. I mean,
Lamar Alexander and Bob Corker.
I didn't tell him.
But Corker's retiring. So.
But we could go on and on. We could go around the country. So he's, and I'm sure that was that passion for politics came from the era in which you grew up and came of age, where there was rapid social change and
that's
politics,
right,
was leading the charge in so many ways.
Exactly.
But you are such a thoughtful guy, and I know you're concerned about the tenor and the tone that we have in this country today. And we're not just talking about the current administration, just
right,
in general, we're talking about a change that we've seen, mm-hmm, over the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know what the solution is. I'm just very disappointed by the direction we're taking as a society right now, because if one side of an issue seems to be, speaking or behaving in an uncivil way, then the other side feels like, well, I've got to do the same thing to be heard. And that leads to more and more yelling and more name calling. I don't know how we get people to calm down, slow down, bring your voices down, mm-hmm, and just talk to each other,
right,
instead of yelling at each other.
And understand that we may have a difference of opinion, but not to necessarily vilify the other person.
Don't demonize the
We've
person.
Changed in that regard.
We have, yeah.
This is from the audience, and I want to turn now to something else that Spencer is very knowledgeable about and passionate about and has covered his entire life, and that is the weather. And what in today's climate change weather patterns concern you the most? You and I have had some conversations about this.
Yeah.
You have seen, having been obviously a studied observer of the weather over,
yes,
decades, real changes.
Yes. Well, I started taking seriously the warnings of climatologists back in the 70s about the greenhouse effect and putting these heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. They were predicting, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s that we would reach in just a few decades, excuse me, a time when storms would become more frequent, more severe, and of longer duration. And we're seeing that now. And the effect of a rapidly warming planet also has a profound effect on our health and on the survival of the species. So what bothers me most about it, or concerns me most, is not so much what's happening with the atmosphere. It's the people who are denying that it's happening.
Mm.
All around the world, you know, 99% of the climate scientists in the world, from countries in every far corner, are in agreement that what's happening right now has a human component, that our behavior has contributed to this. And yet there's a tiny percentage of people only here in our country, the land of the free and the home of the brave, who have power and who have money, who are pulling us out of global efforts to deal with climate change. So all the other countries in the world except the United States are now working in concert to combat global change, and yet the richest, most powerful country in the world is on an island all by itself, and that island's going to sink if we don't get connected.
Well, you don't even necessarily have to be a weather expert to understand certainly weather patterns have changed in ways that we would not ordinarily expect to observe in our lifetime. These,
right,
are eons where we would see. I mean, we know the planet heats and cools.
Oh, sure. Right.
But to see them, I mean, storms are worse than when I was a kid. Thunderstorms are more ferocious.
Right.
You can see that.
That's right.
And ordinarily, now, the debate can continue on how much human activity has exacerbated that.
Mm-hmm.
But to your point, the scientists all agree we play a role.
Right. Well, you know, Lindsey Graham, who is not a flaming liberal, said in a question about climate change, he accepts the science, by the way. He is one of the few public office holders in his party who will accept it. And a couple of years ago, he was asked why he decided to accept the science of climate change. And Lindsey Graham said, well, if I go to 10 doctors and 9 of them telling me I'm dying, but one says you're okay, why would I believe the one? So that applies also to what the scientists are telling us.
All right. It's been great fun over the years to cover the weather for you, I would think.
It has.
It's something we all have in common. We all experience the weather on a daily basis.
It's true. It's great fun, and not just because of my interest in the weather, but also because I know that I'm reporting on the one topic on the news that affects everybody's lives mm-hmm. and that everybody is interested in. Some people watch the news. They may not care about sports. They may not care about politics or the economic report or whatever. But everybody cares about the weather because it determines how we're going to dress, when we're going to travel, what our recreational plans will be. So I'm the guy.
You are indeed. So one of the things I'm trying to do here for all of you is, and on the radio and here in the room, is give you a broader sense of the Spencer Christian that you did not necessarily know that much about. And he writes a lot about the things we've talked about in the book, but his interest and depth of knowledge on politics is remarkable. Same thing with weather. We could talk about wine, but I won't get to that because I know very little about wine. I wouldn't know quite what questions to ask. But there's another passion that Spencer is remarkably knowledgeable on, and we'll only touch on it just so you get to know that part of him, and that is baseball.
Oh.
Yeah. Right? And you'd be hard-pressed to find a question that would stump Spencer about some sports figure from decades ago who set some record. Why baseball? Why does you like all sports?
I do. I like all sports.
But why baseball?
Well, baseball was the first sport that I played as a kid. And I grew up in a rural town in Virginia. And there weren't any public playgrounds. Well, the ones that existed were segregated. But we didn't have basketball courts and all that. And the schools that we went to were so poor, they didn't even have enough equipment for a football team. But everybody learned to play baseball. It didn't require much equipment. And I grew up in a rural area where we had lots of open fields. So there was space to hit the ball and run and catch the ball. And my dad had been he had played on some not professional teams, but some of those little leagues, regional leagues, when he was a young man back in the late 1930s. And he taught me to play baseball when I was about five, and I had some skill. I wasn't a gifted natural athlete, but I could always hit the ball and had good hand-eye coordination. And I ended up playing baseball in college. It's been a lifelong passion. Yeah.
Did you aspire at some time to like every kid, to go be a major leaguer?
I've had some unrealistic dreams in life, but that was not one of them.
That was not one of them.
No. I dreamed about it, but I never really believed that I had the talent to get to be a major league baseball player. But I knew I could play in high school. I knew I could play in college. Mm-hmm. I knew, I was realistic about my talents in those days. I had a pretty good college career. And I ended up going to a major league tryout, not because I thought I could make the major leagues, but we had there was a guy on my team in college who was a gifted natural athlete, and he was being scouted by the Baltimore Orioles, right? This was 1968, my junior year in college. Scout came to watch this guy, Devereaux. And that day, I went 3-for-5, I'll never forget it, 2 doubles and a home run. and the scout said to me, "Well, son, if you're interested, we're having an open tryout in Petersburg, Virginia." So I went there with my little glove, and I went through the tryout thing, and knowing, of course, that I had no major league talent, but knowing that this was a story I'd be telling for 50 years.
How did it go?
honestly, I got through some of the early trials where size the group down to 9 guys on one side and 9 on the other, and they had a scrimmage game. And I came to bat twice, and I had what they called warning track power. Didn't hit the ball out of the park very often, but out to the wall. I got it close. I hit one off the wall, and I just wanted to demonstrate that I could hit the ball, and I got cut.
They weren't looking for warning track power.
No, they weren't. No, they were looking for something more than that. But there was one guy at the tryout named Al Bumbry, against whom I had played in college, who had about an 18 or 19 year career as a center fielder of the Baltimore Orioles.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. He was at that tryout, and it was very clear that he had the talent.
And what is it about baseball today that still, you follow it closely, what is it about the game that you appreciate? What does it represent to you?
I think it's the pace pace of the game that requires a lot of thinking. I mean, not that basketball and football don't require a lot of thinking, but you have to think faster and you have to move faster, and it's constant go, go, go. But, you know, I like the little lapses in baseball where if you're in the outfield, and that's what I played, you know, there are times when you're not doing very much, you know, you're just watching what's happening and smelling the grass that is freshly mowed. And then, oh, all of a sudden, here comes a fly ball. I got to go get it.
It's like life in a way.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
like
there's
life.
A rhythm to it, and we're not always, shouldn't always be busy.
That's true. And as a guy, I like that. As a guy of slight build, I like demonstrating that I'm strong, right? And because I was a great hitter, I loved going to bat and being able to hit the ball as far as the guy who was 30 pounds heavier than I was and said, see, I'm a tough guy, you know? I like it.
All right. You just did just a hint of something.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to embarrass
you. I know what it was.
You know where I'm going, right?
I said it like Rodney Dangerfield.
The other thing he can do with spooky accuracy.
I tell you, Dan, it's been a rough life, you know. I got no respect. I tell you, it's tough. I told my kid about the birds and the bees. He told me about my wife and the butcher. So it's rough.
Give him a round of applause for that. I forgot. That's something else. Now, you know, having known Mitchell a long time and been in the street, if I had a nickel for every time I heard him do a running, I wouldn't still have to work at ABC 7.
Right.
We're going to wrap up here in a few moments, Spencer, but you've been very generous with your heart and your mind here today and very open. You are in this great book that you've written, and you've shared something that's very intimate with the world that for a long time you wanted to keep secret.
Right.
Understandably. Let me ask you this. You are a husband, father, a weatherman, a broadcaster, a man of faith, a baseball fan, an ex-gambler.
Yeah.
All of these things, these labels we can put on you. Who are you as a person? Who are you?
That's a great question. And I might have different answers on different days, but right now at this moment, I think I'm a person who wants to spread cheer and joy in life. And I feel that I'm fulfilling a purpose when I treat people I meet from various stations in life with the same measure of dignity that I would expect. I hope I've achieved that. That's certainly my aim. When I was leaving the station where I started my career in Richmond to start moving up the ladder, that station threw a party for me in the studio, a going-away party. And as I was leaving the party, I encountered the man who was the janitor of the building, Mr. Johnson, who probably was about the age I am now at that time, an aging black man. Who was passed in the hallways every day by various station employees who didn't look him in the eye or acknowledge his presence or say hello to him. But I always did. I'm not saying that in a self-congratulatory way. That's just the way I was raised. And as I was leaving that going-away party, Mr. Johnson came up to me and put his hand on my shoulder and said, son, your parents raised you the right way because you greet me the same way you greet the president of the station. And then he said, don't lose that. And I hope I haven't lost that. I hope that's who I am, and I hope that's how I'm remembered.
Yeah. I can assure you that is how you'll be remembered, because you have not lost that. Spencer knows the name of every person in that building, and if he doesn't, he always asks. It's that person's name, and he remembers. In other words, you do treat everyone the same. I think that's a value. I'd like to say it's a Southern, but it's something
you
grew up in the South where manners matter. But
right.
That is certainly who you are, Spencer. I want to thank Spencer Christian, ABC 7 television weather anchor and author of the new book, You Bet Your Life, How I Survived Jim Crow Racism, Hurricane Chasing, and Gambling. It's just a terrific story about a life well lived and challenges overcome and opportunities seized and redemption, all of it is there. A reminder to everyone that copies of Spencer's book is for sale, and he'll be pleased to sign the books outside the room following the program. He'd be delighted to do that for you. He's not very approachable, as you can tell. but don't be intimidated. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Dan Ashley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. I want to thank you again, Spencer.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you all.